Sairam, dear listeners, you may remember that last week we presented the first talk in a new series being broadcast by Professor Venkatraman on matters relating to Dharma. Today we present the second program in that series, which would not be a talk but a question and answer type of discussion amongst a studio panel, which would discuss topics and questions arising out of Professor's first talk in this new series. The panelists are Radio Sai's Beshu Prushti and Sri Aman Jhaveri, a research scholar from the Department of Management Studies from the Institute. It may be mentioned that in future, this would be roughly the format of this series, talks by Professor Venkatraman and a Q&A session coming in alternation. So, over now to Professor Venkatraman.
Since the ball has been tossed to me, I have to begin with a protest. My name was not mentioned as a panelist, so what am I doing here? Well, you have to tell me what my role is.
Well, you're the one without whom the panel is of no use.
Oh God, you're flattering me too much. I'm not going to give you any money. Swami is watching from there. Go ahead.
So, Aman is here from the Institute, as Sunil made the announcement. And Aman has heard the talk that you gave last week, as well as he has read Guru Charan Das's book, The Difficulty of Being Good. That is the basis on which we are having this series on Dharma. And I remember you earlier had done a series on the Dharma Vahini.
That's right.
And that was a very elaborate
series. I'm glad you are remembering.
Oh, yes. And that was a very, very insightful series. And I thought, This is really a good time to revisit that series also and juxtapose that as we read this difficulty of being good.
Please, you do that. I've got enough work.
Yeah, no. I mean, that is the homework that we are doing, actually.
Okay, thank you.
That is the homework that we are doing. So, Aman is here, and I would like to ask Aman to take the floor now. And so, Aman, please go ahead and put forth whatever you think Professor can clarify for all of us, as you read the first chapter of the book and Sir's talk in the series.
Thank you, Bishu, and thank you so much, Sir, for having me here today. It's really amazing to have read Sir's talk. I have read the book earlier, but then after going through Sir's talk and then reading the book again, I found myself turning from somebody who believed in what Guru Charan Das said to somebody who's become skeptical of what he's saying.
Yeah, I'm not a convert.
So I don't know whether that's good or bad. But nevertheless, I think it's a great opportunity to clarify some of the doubts that I have, and I felt many of us would probably also have the same doubts. So can I start with a question?
Yeah, right, please away. Please mention what is it that you thought when you read Guru Charan Das's book, and what is the new perspective that you got when you read Sir's talk?
I think the first thing that really hit me when I read Sir's talk on the book was what Sir highlighted as separating God from Dharma. That was not something that I observed when I read the book for the first time, but I felt after going through Sir's talk, I felt it was very, very pertinent. And I think we have never looked at Dharma from that perspective. Is God important to Dharma? Can God be left out of Dharma? Can God be included in Dharma? So there were several questions that came.
Also, can God be excluded from
Dharma? Yes. So there is a question on that, sir. And I think maybe let me start with that question of whether God can be excluded from Dharma. The first question that comes to mind is, what is the role of God in the scheme of Dharma? That is number one. And a leading question to that is, what is the definition of that God who plays a part in Dharma? Is this some universal entity, or is it also a subjective interpretation of God?
Oh boy, now I have to try and understand your question. You see, in the ultimate sense, God is everything, as Professor Radhakrishnan, philosopher, said. That is the ultimate. There is nothing beyond it. Everything else is below this. Now, how do you try to describe this ultimate? By definition, it is beyond description, because as the scripture says, it is beyond mind. You cannot conceive of it in the mind. And it is beyond words. One strategy is to sort of say, is God this, is God that, neti, 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 exclude. And then you come to a dead end. But nevertheless, how is it that we deal with such a thing? That is, none of the things that we can see, feel and talk about, none of the things we can imagine about. Is there any pipeline between us and that God?
Yes.
There sure has to be, because we have come from that God. So yes, God must have surely put some kind of ladder, pipeline, flight to connect
yes.
us.
Yes.
So that operationally is done by going inside. Now inside of me or the organs. Do we go inside the organs? No. You go inside the mind. But what about the mind? That is also inside. But there is a secret door in the vast mind through which you can go out. Now, this might sound very difficult to understand, but even in physics, there is what there is supposed to be a thing called wormhole. And in principle, information and maybe even humans can escape through the wormhole from this universe to other universe, beyond this universe. And science says there is quite likely an infinity of other universes completely different from this. So if science can give a trap door, God must have provided one in order that we access Him. And we say God stays in our heart, not the physical heart. And the mind can go to God in some way. Essentially, what it does is, the mind has some sicknesses. If it gets rid of those sicknesses, mind will have all the attributes of God, and the difference between mind and God disappears. In other words, whatever you are made up of three things, the Atman inside you, the mind and the body. The body dies, so there's no problem. There are fellows who will take care of it. Somebody else will pay them to do the job. The mind has lost all its identity, and there is no such thing as a mind and the Atman. That's one. That is what we call liberation, moksha, etc., etc. In other words, there is what you call a potentiality for us to become one with God. Now you say, what is this got to do with dharma? Okay. Now, dharma must be understood at two levels. One is the source, and other is the action flowing from the source. Just to give an example, if you go to some place in the north, there is some kind of a cave from which water comes. That is supposed to be, I think it's called Gomukhi.
Gomuk.
And
the origin of original. River Ganga.
And the water that flows out comes as Ganges in the very elemental form. Then it acquires tributaries. So there is a connection between Gomukh or Gomukhi and the Ganges. Bhagirathi, I believe it is called there.
Yeah, at the first.
So there is a connection.
Level.
So can, in relation to God and man and dharma, how do you establish the connection? Well, most people say God is truth. Gandhiji said God is truth, and my way of approaching that truth is through ahimsa. And Swami has said God is truth, satya, actually is rhythm, beyond satya. And you as humans, when you translate satya into action, action can be in the mind, through the words, and the body. Three types of action. If all those are truthful, in harmony with the truth, satya, which is like the tambura, and they are always so, then dharma flows out of that gomukh called satya. So satya is the source, that is God. And God in action is always dharmic. If you are in your actions are truthful like God is, loving as God is, helpful like God is, compassionate like God is, your action is entirely dharmic. In other words, I have a reference and I relate all this to reference. Now the gentlemen of today and also ladies of today throw away the reference. And then they have to have some means of definition. You can write any definition you want that is convenient to you. Because you are in control of the definition and the actions. That is, I think, the fundamental this thing. If you exclude God, a lot of the thing becomes sort of floating. There is no rule or this thing, anchor or basis. I hope that makes it somewhat
yes,
clear.
Yes, somewhat clear, but there's another leading question now to that. Mm-hmm. And the question is this, sir. The intention of Guru Charan Das in this book seems to be very noble. He wants mm-hmm. to create a good civil society.
Mm-hmm. As he very clearly says, I want to create, know what is the civic virtue
exactly.
that helps society, and he wanted to get it from India's foundational text, as he says.
Exactly. So my question is, the problems that we see today in today's society seem to be stemming from this notion of God itself, which you have referred to as a reference point. So, from a third person perspective, as somebody who just wants to live in a good society, wouldn't that actually be a good idea to exclude God from dharma? Because the problem today seems to be emerging from subjective interpretations of God. So if I'm able to exclude this very notion of God from dharma and still be able to create a society that is moral and ethical, that would seem to solve a lot of problems.
It would be more universal, is that what you are referring
to? Yes, it would be more universal, it may appeal to more number of people, and because there is no God involved, it may not even have that religious connotation to it.
Look, I have one problem with this. On the face of it, that looks like an ideal approach. But, supposing you go to a field, there are two teams. They say we'll play football. Soccer, as it is called in America. There must be A rules, there must be goalposts. If each team has its own rules and its own goalpost, then you are playing a new game. I am not making this up. There was a very interesting incident in the history of cricket, mm-hmm. and I think I must tell it because sure. I love that game. Though I complain, don't talk about the latter. Many, many years ago, before the war, Second World War, an Australian team went to West Indies. West Indies, that in those days was one dominion of the British Commonwealth. Today, all those countries come together as West Indies only for cricket, not anything else. in Olympics, Jamaica, Barbados, they all compete separately as different countries. But for cricket, they are still West Indies. The Australian team at that time was led by Sir Don Bradman. He was knighted later. And that was a hectic tour, because West Indies is a real professional team. On the way, they were coming back via New York. So they wanted to see New York, because Australians in those days could not get a chance to go there. And Don says that it was a great experience. You could walk in the streets of New York. Nobody recognized him, nobody cared a damn. He couldn't do that in London. He will be mobbed. And then there was a small West Indies expat community. They said, while you have, let's have a festival match. And Don said, okay. The match was in progress. Australian team on one side, and expats, maybe one or two from India. In those days, there were very few Indians. Mostly it was Jamaicans and Barbados and places like that, Trinidad. And then he found something funny going on. He stopped the game and called both the umpires. He said, something is funny. The overs at one length don't seem to be of the same. And the one fellow said, I thought you were playing under British rules, so I gave 6 balls an over. The other fellow said, I thought you were playing under Australian rules, and I gave 8 balls an over. At that time, Australian over was 8 balls. Okay. English over was 6 balls. What I'm trying to say is, this fellow had one set of rules, that fellow had one set of rules. And this fellow was confused. Now, if you leave the issue of what is a righteous action to what people believe in, I can conveniently decide what I am doing is right. In today's war, for example, people fight. Everybody says, I am doing what God wants me to. This happened in the American Civil War also. And a pastor went to Abraham Lincoln, who was the president of America, and he was fighting the Civil War because the South was trying to break away. And the pastor said, Mr. President, we are sure to win the war because God is on our side. And the president looked at the pastor and said, Mr. Pastor, what is important is for us to be on God's side. Yes. We don't know on whose side God is. So, unless you have a reference, you cannot define. The reference may be good or bad, but we have a reference. Every country has a constitution. The laws of that land are framed according to the constitution of that country. Now, if you go there, those are the laws, you have to obey those laws. If you go to some other country, the laws are different. Income tax laws, for example. Yes. Traffic violation laws, for example. Where in those matters, the question of right and wrong are fairly easy to understand in terms of sheer common sense. Yes. But where certain issues are there, these things become difficult. And they become matters of law. Today, thanks to science is far, far ahead of law. Law has no answers. Today, thanks to science, you can go and drop bombs and wipe out an entire city. It has been done even in World War II. In the old days, you killed an enemy attacking you with arms. Right. You know, when you go and bomb a whole city and wipe out the population, is that correct? What they say is this is collateral damage. You bring in some funny legal word. In order to achieve the victory in the end, I am doing this. Mm-hmm. So you have a fundamental question. Does the end justify the means? Okay. Now you may say yes under certain circumstances. All right. But you who believe in God can ask that question, oh Lord, do you accept whether the end justifies the means? This is a fundamental question. Therefore, another question. Now they have what is called surrogate mothers. Gujarat is full of them. So, we normally define the mother as the one who gives birth to the baby. In this case, who is the mother? This question arises because we are going against nature. Do we have the moral authority to go against nature? There are questions that lead from there. What is nature? Nature is made up of land, air and water. It was constructed in a certain manner and given to us. Can we go against this nature? Are we allowed to pollute air? Are we allowed to pollute water, which was given to all of it was given to us as free?
Right.
So you dodge and twist yourself into knots and ultimately get into all kinds of complications, especially because everyone has the freedom to choose.
Right. Yeah, but what Aman is saying is everybody has his own interpretation of God. And
that makes it even worse.
That's why when you hinge dharma onto God and everybody has his own subjective interpretation of God.
Nobody has given a definition of God. As Gandhiji very rightly says in his famous spiritual message to the world, which was recorded by Columbia Gramophone Company in 1931, when he went to attend the second roundtable conference. He says, he is no God who merely satisfies the intellect. God to be God must rule the heart and transform the senses. And he says, God must be seen through the goodness of human beings. They are just translating God through the goodness. What is the patent, manifest evidence of goodness? Actions, speech, thoughts. The thoughts may make me smile. That itself is an action. I can understand. I can experience. Compassion is goodness. I don't want anything from you. I just do it because I see you as a reflection of myself. So,
unfortunately, everybody doesn't have this enlightened view of God.
That's why we are supposed to be having all this. No, you are right. But what is the reason for that? There has been a calculated attempt during the last 1.5 centuries to deflect attention from that which led to good behavior, good conduct, and honesty and all that, which was the norm at that time. You created distractions. You created less time for you to commune with God and with nature. This is, when I say you, I mean the market and social forces. And today, unfortunately, God is not available on the cell phone. And so you forget God. But long ago, Swami said, Om is my telephone number.
Yes.
Therefore, you have two things, time and money, hopefully. If you don't have money, they won't care for you. But if you have money, then they'll take away your time and through that your money. And your work, essentially at the mercy of these agents that distract you. For that they plant viruses in the mind. Just as they plant viruses in your computer, there are viruses that are planted in your mind, and that's the end of it.
And
your mind goes corrupt.
You know, if we talk about dharma with God as the reference point.
Yes.
Now, one challenge that could come up is, how could we take dharma to all those people who profess that they are quote-unquote secular?
Right.
We cannot take dharma to them. They'll just switch off. Like, for example, I know of so many self-development courses. I've attended some of them just to explore what it is. Mm-hmm. They talk about, you know, how to refine your thinking, how to develop your soft skills, and how to lead a life of where you have less tension and less stress, and etc., etc. They have their own package, but they do not bring morality in, they do not bring spirituality in, because they want to quote-unquote keep it secular. Because of that, they definitely get a bigger crowd. I understand that. But yeah, there is a vacuum there. I accept that. There is a vacuum there. But most of the people don't feel it because they haven't really experienced, they don't know what they are missing. But the same thing, but at least they're able to take and help some people. The same thing, that same challenge that we'll face with dharma is, one, the moment you say dharma has got to do with God, you have to have a reference point, you have to first believe in God, then only then you can be dharmic. Then, you know, we'll be losing out a major chunk of people who said, okay, we don't want to have anything to do with it. This is all another of those things where we don't want to be associated.
And also, sir, just to add to what Bishu said, we see around ourselves several people who claim to be believing in God, but they're outrightly adharmic. Whereas we see so many people, like for example, the famous economist, Amartya Sen, he's an agnost. But if you look at his work, he has dedicated his work to the development of poor people, to poverty alleviation. So, I feel when I look around myself, I find people who say they believe in God and they do adharmic acts. And then there are people who say they don't believe in God and yet they are quite ethical and moral. So how do we reconcile these diverging views?
What does Swami say? You have been in Swami's institutions.
Yeah, I mean, one way of looking at it is, I would say that even though all those people say they are atheists, in real sense they are not. Because if they believe in truth, if they believe in compassion, if they believe in selfless love, even though they may not believe in Rama or Krishna, that doesn't make them an atheist. That's what I would think. If they believe in these eternal values, nobody is an atheist that way, in that sense.
See, we have to first of all realize that it is really not our job to transform society. Mm-hmm. If we think we are doing that, we are thinking too much of ourselves. Okay. So let me just abandon that idea. Does that mean I forget society? No, nothing of the sort. I can transform society in an entirely different way, not by preaching, but become a symbol of love that does not expect anything, real compassion, and try to bring joy to people who are unhappy for many reasons. Even a person like Amartya Sen must have certain problems. Life is full of problems. Without talking about God, you can just make them happy. Doctors do this with their patients and all that. So there is a model. The Mahatma Gandhi just did not bother about trying to convert anybody. He said, this is what I believe in. And he tried to explain that in a very, very simple manner. That is very compulsive. And there, I would recommend everyone to read the text of Gandhi's speech in 1931. It is now available in YouTube as an audio. It is exactly 6 minutes. And he just, in 500 or so words, explains what his relationship to God is. First he asks, I see so many wonderful things. Where did they come from? He doesn't know. And then he quotes his tour in Mysore. He said, when I toured Mysore last year, I met many poor villagers they who did not know who ruled Mysore. They simply said some god rules it. Then he says, if the knowledge of these villagers can be so limited in relation to their ruler, I, who am infinitely lesser in relation to God than they to their ruler, need not be surprised if I do not know who my ruler is. Then he says, this power, is it good or bad? And he comes to the conclusion, it must be good, because in the midst of darkness, light persists. In the midst of untruth, truth persists. And in the midst of evil, good persists, and something like that. So this is a good, benevolent power. It is benevolent or malevolent. He comes to the conclusion, benevolent. Then can I see God? And said, don't waste your time. He is beyond the senses. Sense perception can be false and untrue. I don't define God by intellectually proving to myself God exists. And then he says, there are good people. They are manifestations of God. I'll try to tell, be humble. I personally feel it is safer to follow God and His instruction. Because if I violate some rule of the state and I say, I was ignorant, I don't know about it, law does not care. Ignorance is no excuse. You go to Singapore and drop rubbish, you're promptly fined and so on. You can't say, I'm a newcomer, I don't know the rules. If the states can do that, God can jolly well do that. It's a humble and meek acceptance of the divine is the simplest thing. He does not bring any religion. He just say, I as an individual and God there. He does not say God is black or white. What he does, is he sitting like an accountant all the time, marking you bad, good, a scorer, umpire, anything, nothing. He is just goodness by himself, and he is silence, he is peace, he is ahimsa, all those are latent. But he cannot manifest it, so he creates people and manifests them. So I don't preach. You talked about that Kalyan Sundaram. He never preached, his actions converted.
Yeah, Gandhiji's secretary.
So what I will do is, I will use these methods of goodness. There are so many methods. And try to tell these things to people and make them think. You don't have to, I'm not asking you to convert. See, this is this. This is the advantages and these are disadvantages. Even in the Gita, you will find at the end of it, Krishna tells Arjuna, Arjuna, I have told you everything. Have you listened? Yes. Now, what is going to be your decision? There are two options. Short-term option, long-term option. If you take the short-term option, these are the pros and cons. If you take the long, these are the pros and cons. What is sweet in the beginning becomes poison in the end. That's short-term. What is bitter in the beginning becomes nectar in the end. That's a long-term. Now you have to choose. So, we don't try to proselytize anybody. We are not asking, declare yourself for a Swami, declare yourself for God. You bring a certain higher rationality about why things exist, why things are going the way you are. Just take a simple example. Nobody polluted the earth the way we are doing. Of course, you may say they didn't have the muscle power. Leave that aside. They were genuinely worshipping the element, saying, doing this hurts us.
Right.
It hurts our sentiments. Even today, big fight in Orissa about that mountains with Vedanta company in UK. They don't believe God is there. It's nonsense to talk like that. You see, you may say, but it gives us sustenance. That is why we call it God. Mother sustains us. These are two feelings. And in the long run, one day Swami gave a discourse in Trai, I remember. He says, people come from other countries. The Indians are stupid. They are superstitious. They worship snake. They worship cows. They worship all sorts of things. They say sun is God. What is sun? It's just a cloud that is burning. And so on. Then he says, but look at what these people do. They hunt species out of tribe, the existence. They cut down forests. They destroy mountains. They pollute rivers. They pollute air. And you call them civilized, educated? Our tribals may not be educated, but they know what to respect and what not to destroy. So there are what you call perspectives. And even the Ramayana can be presented in such a way, it raises questions in relation to today's world. Yes. I'll give one simple example because these are things that are not noted. When Rama waits near the sea for the Lord of the Sea to appear, he doesn't appear. He calls for him, he doesn't. Then he says, I'm going to shoot an arrow and evaporate the whole sea. The Lord of the Sea comes. He says, I know you are impatient. But you know, this cannot be done. He said, what do you mean it cannot be done? I want to go to Lanka, you are not giving me a way. He said, if I empty the sea, the fish will die. You have created the fish. You have appointed me to a position. Are you asking me to disobey your law? This is in the worldly context. The boss will say rule and say cheat nevertheless. So then he says, I know what you want. You want to go to Sri Lanka, build a bridge. And there is an engineer, Vishwakarma is there, his son is there, you ask him to build a bridge. Today, we don't respect the sea. We pollute it like anything. We don't respect the air, we pollute it like anything. We don't respect land, we don't pollute. Now the story of the Ramayana intuitively enabled ordinary people to understand what Dharma was about. As Kanchi Paramacharya said, it is what you call Vedas converted into some simple stories through which they can understand principle. So I got lost, I don't know where I came. But basically, we don't try to convert. We just try to explain logically, which can be done within the context of today's life.
Appeal to everyone's higher...
Rather make them think.
Think, yeah.
You think, see, for example, a lot of people said, why should we go to the Mars? There are questions. Knowledge is worth seeking for its own sake because it enables us to understand many things.
I mean, there is a sense of goodness in everyone. There is that spark of whatever you may call it.
No, there's no question.
Yeah. And so if you appeal to that power, if you appeal to that good sense that is there,
there is a very important point. You talked about, you know, definition of God. Basically, at the working level, there are two definitions. If I may put it, it's not an exact statement. The Western world sees God, their Western religions, so-called, are Judaism, Christianity, and even Islam is part of the Abrahamic religion. That's the correct word. All of them have a picture of God, who is described in the Old Testament. He is called a punishing God. He's like an accountant watching you all the time. Accountant, policeman, police commissioner, judge, jury, everything. He has no other work. And in the, some people did not like it. So what they did in the Christianity was, they created a son of God, who was a real historical character, and they left a father, they concentrated on the son, who was goodness. They were more comfortable with it. Yes. And then there was yet another version of this. And instead of Jesus Christ, he lost the job, it was given to Muhammad. But the God was the same. They called him Allah instead of Jehovah, or whatever it is. And they also accepted Christ as a prophet.
Yes.
And they said, he is not the ultimate prophet. Ultimate prophet is Muhammad. And so on. Yes. So there is a certain theology of God. In the East, at least in what is called Hinduism or Sanatana Sarthi, we started with the gods of nature, Indra, Varuna, etc. And Krishna says that's not the God. He says they have bosses, so go to them. Essentially, that is the Govardhan story.
Yes, yes.
And he reveals, I am the ultimate.
Yes.
That's, I am Purushottama, I am Brahman. That's what he says. Aham Brahmasmi, then they began to say.
Yes.
So this is an entirely different concept. Where in Christianity, everybody is a child of evil. What you call temptation and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Here, we are Amritasya Putra.
Yes.
We have come from the pure. Only thing is we get contaminated here. So decontaminated, you are back to source.
Right. Yes.
There you say black cannot become white. So there are what you call theologies, but you can analyze it in a simpler way. Gandhi says there is a force. And when you went to give a record of a program, only time we went to a radio station, somebody asked, what do you think of radio? I see Shakti, the power of God in it. That's all. One word. That is true. Otherwise, sun, unimaginable power, oceans, unimaginable power. Sorry, I think it looks like we are approaching cutoff time, but go ahead.
I mean, we've got somewhere in trying to discuss about how it is important to have that frame of reference when we are discussing dharma, and you cannot do without it.
Not only that, even in science, if I don't have a frame of reference, I cannot do science, I cannot do maths.
Yes.
If I want to do geometry, I use Euclidean geometry, that's good for anything that is flat like this table.
Yes.
But if I want to do the geometry on the sphere, I have to go to spherical geometry. This won't work there.
Yes.
People don't realize that.
Yes.
So frame of reference is very important.
And the frame of reference is different of Gurucharan Das and your talk. And that is where you find whole new perspectives.
I would say Gurucharan Das creates his own frame, which is questionable because it's very fluid. Anybody can have his own frame.
Yes.
Then, you know, it's arguing endlessly. I'm right, you are right, you are wrong, you are right, I'm wrong.
And this and perhaps that is the reason why the conclusion that he reaches, he says that, you know, dharma is ambivalent. If anything, it has probably, he says, it has made me only more ambivalent. And, you know, there are these statements that he makes that although human perfection may be illusory, dharma may be subtle. And there are limits to what moral education can achieve. And he says the epic leaves one with the confidence that it is in our own nature also to be God, or also to be good. And he says, okay, that...
Where does that come from?
From the prelude.
No. Nature to be good.
Yeah.
There is a seed of goodness in you.
He doesn't acknowledge that frame of reference, but he says, when you read the whole epic, there is this feeling that, we have to be good.
So that's why I'm saying we must have series like this,
where
you present an alternative, view of things. And the alternative view of things is more comprehensive in that it goes beyond the senses. Unless we go beyond the senses, where there is a world of its own, we cannot understand this. To say there is nothing beyond the senses is taking point of view, and it's a stubborn, non-compromising point of view. That's not correct, in my opinion.
Actually, there are a lot more questions that Aman had put down, and even I had, and the time is running out.
No, but today it's running out. You can call. We can meet again.
If you permit, can we continue the Q&A session next week also?
As long as you give me notice.
Before...
Actually, that suits me because my next talk will be later. I'm ready with it. Maybe I will ask Sunil to record it separately. I will bribe him to get a slot. Here I am looking at Swami.
Because there are many more interesting...
You know, my bribe is nice words, kindness and all.
So probably we hope and pray that we can have you again next week.
Why do you have to pray? Say, just come and tell
pray
me. I'm here in the other building.
No, pray to Swami because so many things have to fall in place.
Swami has told me, so you have to be, they have to pray to me for you to go and do your damn work. This is what you are supposed to do.
So thank you very much, sir. And thank you, Aman, for coming all the way to the university.
So I wind up, I must have at least the last word.
Sure, always.
So maybe you will fake the answer, but did you really get anything out of this?
Oh, definitely.
Sure?
I think, definitely.
Okay, I will believe you.
Sir, I'll not say I didn't get anything from this. But I would say that what I've got is not yet complete in a sense that I would have been satisfied.
Listen, the same with me.
That is a long story. You and I have to take 100 genmas minimum. This understanding truth is what you call an asymptotic process. You will reach it only at infinity.
As you mentioned, this will make us think, and that is important.
We have to think a lot. We have to think a lot. And as far as being good is concerned, there is a shortcut which people do not realize. That is one of the things. Being good by yourself is an extremely tough process.
Yes.
But
so
I can ask one...
the difficulty of being
no,
good.
No. There is a simple way out. Supposing I say I love Swami immensely. I just ask a question. I want to do this. Will Swami be happy if I do this? Or will he not be happy if I do this?
Yes.
Give an honest answer to your question. 99% out of 100, I'm just allowing 1% error.
Yes.
You will do the right thing.
Yes.
Because he is in your heart.
Absolutely.
And he's a fool, don't do this. Mm-hmm. I didn't train you and bring you up for this. Very simple.
So could this also become the basis for each individual to define his own way of interpreting and practicing dharma?
That is, if you ask God or Swami or Krishna or whoever it is, approve of what you are doing, you will have a very good GPS system. The question of God and all that, you don't have to worry. You have
at
to go somewhere.
Time.
I have, my compass only shows where the north is. And in one film that I saw, two fellows are in a boat. And one fellow has a compass. This chap asked the other chap, where is the compass? I threw it. said, why? We are supposed to go south and it's always showing north. So, that kind of... But GPS, it takes you almost to your destination these days with fantastic accuracy. You need a moral GPS.
Yes.
And dharma is more or less a moral GPS.
Yes, absolutely.
It makes sure your action in thought, word and deed are in the right direction.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
If you remember it that way, it is not all that subtle. But there are situations which can be very complicated, very thin line.
There will be this dharmic dilemma.
That is
the confusion about what is this voice coming from within.
No, that is also where what is called dharma sankatam.
Dharma sankatam.
It becomes very difficult.
That's where, sir, I would like to end. Maybe the next question that we can take up was, one thing that you and Guru Charan Das both agree is that it is difficult to follow dharma. So the next logical question is, from where does this difficulty arise? Is it metaphysical, is it sociological, or is it psychological? Some hints are given where he describes two personalities, one that seeks selfishness and the other that is not selfish. But maybe we would like to hear from sir. Yes. Where do these difficulties arise from?
Yes. You see, difficulty ultimately boils down to what is called the price, what may be called the price.
Okay. So that's what we'll take up next week.
No price from you don't have to pay any price to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
And how about reminding the listeners? Don't be passive. Fire questions.
Yes. Dear listeners, please, we are having this Q&A session after listening to the first talk that Professor has given on the series, a new series on Dharma, after that series on Dharma Vahini. And this series is because Sir wanted to comment on a book written by Guru Charan Das. The book is called The Difficulty of Being Good. And the subtitle of the book is On the Subtle Art of Dharma. The Difficulty of Being Good on the Subtle Art of Dharma. That is a book written by a very well-known writer, Guru Charan Das. And Sir read the prelude, and based on what he read and his comments, we had the talk which we played last Thursday. And today we had the first Q&A session based on that talk. And we will continue this Q&A session next week. So if you have any questions based on the talk or based on what discussion we had today, please feel free to send. We will take up those questions too in the coming sessions of this series. Over now to Sunil for the final announcement.
So, Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end the first Q&A session on Professor G. Venkatraman's earlier talk in the new series related to Dharma. We hope you liked this session and remind you that next week they would be coming back with Professor's continuing Q&A session. He has agreed to continue on this Q&A session in the present series. Please do not forget to tune in then, and we shall alert you in advance with web and radio announcements. We thank you for listening and request you, those that whom you know, that please be and bring this series to their awareness, and also join us in future. As usual, the podcast of this program may be accessed via our website www.radiosai.org. Thank you, and Jai Sai Ram. We now bring you the next segment, Service, Love in Action.